A preschool class was asked to draw a picture of what they wanted to be when they grew up. And different kids were drawing pictures of firemen or policemen and, you know, different occupations. And one little girl seemed to be struggling a little bit with her picture, and she looked rather exasperated. And a teacher came over to her and said, honey, what is the problem? And she said, with her hands on her hips, she said, well, when I grow up, I want to be married, and I don't know how to draw it. Well, have you ever felt that way about marriage? You want a sound, stable, secure, successful marriage, but you're not sure how to draw it. You're not quite sure what it means. You're not quite sure how to go about it. Norma Jean and I have been married going on 45 years now. I don't consider myself an expert, and yes, I know that's longer than you've been born, Mark. I know, we all know that. But we're still working on it. We're still drawing the picture. We're still painting the painting. And I suspect for those of you here that have been married as long or longer, you could probably say the same thing. And there's some of you that are just starting. But I will tell you this, in the years that we have been married, and the study that I have done from the Bible, and the observations that I have made in talking with and counseling with countless other couples, I feel like I have some idea of some of the components that are going to be needful for you to have a sound and successful marriage. And so this evening we want to talk about 6 secrets of a satisfying marriage, or 7 secrets. That part's a secret. I'll tell you at the end about that. But we're going to talk about some secrets of a satisfying marriage. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here tonight. And thank you again for inviting my wife and I to come and to be with you this week. I appreciate very much the kind way in which you have received us today and made us feel welcome and feel at home. And we have made other connections. Norma Jean said this afternoon that we have even more connections here than we realized that we had. And one of the connections is Norma Jean has a cousin who has a daughter who is married to a guy whose father and mother attend here. That is a very tight connection for us. I don't even know what I just said. I'm not even sure if I got that quite right or not. But at any rate, it's kind of interesting as you go around and visit different places you've never been, and find out you know a lot of the same people and have a lot of the same friends. And Brad Walker was sharing with me about some of the people he went to FC with, and they're good friends of ours. You know, someone said to Dee Bowman one time, he said, well, it's a small world, isn't it, Dee? He said, no, it's just a big brotherhood. And that sure is true, isn't it? So we're glad to be a part of that brotherhood and to count you in it and be a part of our study tonight. And this week, we have a good number back tonight. If you're a guest as a speaker tonight, I welcome you. And I know the brethren here in this church family are glad to have you. And we hope tonight's lesson will be helpful. This series is going to be a very practical series. There's going to be nothing theoretical about it. We're going to be making a lot of application to Bible passages and looking at precepts and principles that we can look in our lives and our marriages and our homes that I think will help us. So tonight we want to think about some things that will produce, I believe, a successful and a satisfying marriage. Okay, everybody got their sermon notes? You ready to write? All right. Number one is a commitment to the relationship of marriage. A commitment to the relationship of marriage. I've already indicated in earlier studies this morning, especially in the Bible study hour, that commitment is not what it was a number of years ago. Certainly in our society, it is not. When I was growing up as a kid and going to Cartersburg Elementary School in Indiana, there was not one kid in our class whose parents were divorced. Not one. I mentioned talking to that particular teacher. I was talking to another teacher at one time, and we were discussing this point. She had 26 kids in her class that particular year. She said 23 had different last names than their parents. That's how many molded or broken homes or melted homes that there were in that particular classroom. And that's pretty typical today in our society. But what does God have to say about it? What does God have to say about our commitment to the relationship of marriage? Well, the prophet Malachi put it this way, and he said, God hates divorce. Now, that's just a fact. Divorce is not something that God has in mind when we take our vows. When we stand before a preacher or justice of peace or whomever, and we say, I do. God doesn't have a mind for us to be divorced. Jesus said in Matthew 19 and verse 6, what God had joined together, let not man separate. I believe that it's God that joins a man and a woman together as husband and wife. And certainly there are laws that we follow. There's a civil aspect to that. But there is a component of that that is divine, as we talked about in our lesson this morning. That God ordered and arranged and ordained the marital relationship. Now, someone may say, well, wait a minute, Ken. In Matthew 19, Jesus gives a reason for divorce. And you're absolutely right about that. And I believe in Matthew 19:9 that there is an exception based on sexual immorality. But you know, I'm afraid too many times, ladies and gentlemen, we want to talk about the exception. And we get in all kinds of discussions about that exception and what that exception means and how you apply that exception. And there are areas, I'm going to tell you what, sometimes it's hard for me to unravel the knots in the rope. I mean, I know what that says. And I believe I understand the principle of it. And yet, I read a question one time, Mark, a guy wrote years ago in a paper about this marital problem. And I can't even, it was so complicated, who divorced who and who, what had happened and all of this sort of thing. And they want to know what the answer was. I thought, how in the world is this preacher going to answer that question? And he knew the answer. I'm not so sure I knew the answer. It was really a complicated mess that these people have gotten their lives into. And I think what we need to do is to go back and to talk about the principle. Yes, there is an exception, but you don't enter into marriage thinking about the exception, do you? You don't enter into marriage thinking about someone that's going to be unfaithful to you. And so we need to be preaching to our young people the fact that you are married for life, one man for one woman for life. That's God's plan. You know, in some marriage ceremonies anymore, they're changing it from as long as you both shall live to as long as you both shall love. And so when you fall out of love, then you can just get a divorce and you're not committed to that relationship. You know what I call those marriages? I call those chewing gum marriages. You know what chewing gum marriage is? You know, you get a stick of gum and you chew it, you get rid of all the sweetness, then you throw it away and get another stick. And that's the way some people look at marriage, that you get into a relationship with someone and you just get all the sweetness out of that relationship and you're tired of that person, you discard that person and find someone else that's a little sweeter. Until you get tired of them and squeeze all that out and go to somebody else. And that's what's going on in our culture today. And we need to come back to the commitment to the relationship of marriage. A lot of people feel like a young man that said he was felt cheated by his marriage. He said he felt cheated in his relationship. He said, when I got married, it started off as an ideal. Within a few months, it turned to an ordeal. And he said, now I'm looking for a new deal. And that is typical of a lot of folks in our culture today. I've heard people say, well, the grass is greener on the other side. Have you ever heard that? I've heard it. You know where the grass is greener? The grass is greener where you water it. That's where the grass is greener. And what we're trying to do in this series and our study tonight is to talk about how you can water the grass where you are. And if we would spend as much time and effort and energy sometimes in our marriage and our relationships with the one that we pledge to live with for the rest of our lives, rather than cultivating relationships somewhere else where we shouldn't be, our relationship at home would be a lot better. And that's just a fact. The grass is greener where you water. So the first thing is that we need to be committed to the relationship of marriage. Secondly, there needs to be a communication of thoughts. There's a great, you know, it's really ironic today when you think about all the communication that we have today with email And we have with our texting with phones and your iPads and, I mean, all the kind of things we have to communicate. And yet there's not a lot of communication going on one-to-one between husbands and wives and families. One survey said the average couple only talks to each other 4 minutes a day. That's hard for me to believe. That's 28 minutes a week. Can you imagine that? But that's what the survey said. But I want to tell you what, when we don't communicate, you're going to start having a problem in your relationship. Dr. Paul Faulkner wrote, communication is to love what blood is to the body. When communication stops, love begins to die. And that's exactly right. And I will just admit to you, the biggest culprits usually are, not always, not 100% of the time, but probably 80% of the time, the biggest culprits of the communication problem is us guys. I mean, we're just known a lot of times not to be real good with communication. In fact, it's proven that females tend to develop their communication skills earlier than boys do and want to communicate. Tell you a cute little story. We've got a little gal where I preach at Hickman Mills named Meredith. She just turned 9. She's like 9 going on 19. She's a precocious little thing, just a sweetheart. And in fact, when we first moved there, she had written me a note thanking me for doing sermon notes. She was only 8 then. And we was over at her house. I said, Meredith, I got your little note. Do you take sermon notes? She says, oh, yes, I like your sermon notes. 8 years old. Wow. And so she's every once in a while write me a note and draw me a picture of some little skinny guy, you know, in the pulpit and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's about 100 feet tall and all that. I love these pictures the kids draw. It's great. And, you know, she'll bake cookies. One time her mother and Norma went out somewhere and she baked me a couple cookies and wrote me another note. Well, I started reading this note and she was thanking me for stuff. But then she said, Mr. Ken, I have a problem. Now, what problem could a 9-year-old girl have? Well, here was her problem. She said, there's a little boy at church named Andrew that follows me around and wants to play. And she said, I don't want to play anymore. I want to sit and talk, and he doesn't want to talk. And then she asked me for advice, what should I do? You know, I wanted to write and tell her, honey, it doesn't get any better. Andrew doesn't want to talk. He's not going to talk later on. That's boys for you. All right. But I didn't have the heart to burst the bubble of a 9-year-old girl. And so I came up with something that I wrote back to her about her problem with a little boy that didn't want to talk. We got to work at communication. Now, the Bible has a lot to say. In fact, sometimes when I have a little bit more time to do this series, I'll do a whole lesson just on communication. You see, and that kind of changes, see, the number. See, this number of 6 secrets or 5 secrets or 7 secrets kind of varies a little bit, depending on how much time I got, and I'll explain that a little bit more at the end. So let's think about some communication principles. One communication principle that will help you is be honest. Tell the truth. Now, this is not just true in the marriage. This is true in the home totally. Husbands and wives, parents and children, tell the truth. Paul said, therefore, put away lying and let each one of you speak the truth to his neighbor, for we're members of one another. That ought to start in the home. Have you ever heard someone say, well, preacher, don't you know the truth hurts? You know, sometimes the truth does hurt, doesn't it? You know what hurts worse than the truth? A lie. Doesn't it? When you find out that someone you love has lied to you, that hurts a lot worse than the truth ever would. So first of all, your communication, be honest, tell the truth. But then say it kindly. Sometimes people will say the most hurtful, blunt kind of things, and then they will stand behind what I just said. Well, it was the truth. Well, yeah, it was. But you didn't have to phrase it that way. Can't you say it kindly? Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, and be kind to one another. And so we can learn to be kind in our communication. Don't look corrupt. In fact, the word corrupt there, I know some of you are probably disappointed that I've gone this long and I haven't got into the Greek. Most members really like preachers getting into the Greek. They say, is he serious? No, I'm just kidding. All right. But that is an interesting word there. The word means putrid or defiling. And that's the kind of corrupt communication. There is communication. It's just putrid. It's defiling. It's rotten. It's corrupt. Don't let that kind of language come out of your mouth, but that which edifies or builds up. That which is kind, say it kindly. And then number three, avoid anger. Now, we are going to do a whole lesson on anger. And so let me just quote this verse. Soft answer turns away wrath. Grievous words stir up anger. And so learn to avoid getting angry and losing your temper. Number four, use encouraging words. Proverbs 16:24 says, pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness of the soul, and health to the bones. Or Proverbs 12:25, heaviness on the heart of a man makes it stoop, but a good word makes it glad. Don't you like to come home to a good word? Come home to a good word. If you're home first and your spouse comes in, have a good word. You know, you don't have to start off with all the problems of the day and all the trials and all the challenges and all the bad things that have happened. Start off with a good word. Encourage one another. And then listen. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. You know what my natural tendency is? My natural tendency is to be quick to speak and slow to listen. Now, I don't know if that's yours or not, but that's pretty much a human tendency. And so if we're going to improve the communication in our marriage relationships, we must be quick to listen. And guys, again, we're some of the worst culprits of this. My wife tests me on this all the time. And she would say, did you hear what I said? And I like to play tricks with her now and act like I'm not listening when I am. I know that shocks you that I'd want to do that. But then she'll say, did you? I said, yeah, and I'll repeat it back word for word. Okay. Say, all right. But women like for you to listen. And probably secretly, us guys kind of like for our wives to listen to us too, if we would admit it. Learn to listen. That will improve your communication skills. And sometimes when we get older, we got to kind of work on that a little harder. You know, kind of like the three ladies on a train in England. And one lady looked out the window and she said, is this Wimberley? And the second lady said, no, it's Thursday. And the third said, I am too. Let's get a drink. So you run into that sort of thing down the road. All right. Number three is a consideration of feelings. Consideration means paying attention. It means to empathize with the way that others feel. It means to show common courtesy. It is the idea of having regard for someone you love, of being thoughtful for them. You know, guys, it means waiting till she has both legs in the car before you take off. Just a little consideration. Yeah. Just a little thing. It may even mean when she's come home from the grocery and it's the, you know, 2 minutes to go in the game and it's a 1-point game that you got to carry in the groceries. Yeah. That's why you pay extra for DVR so you can pause the TV. That's worth that. In fact, she may, now surely your wife wouldn't do this to you, have a serious question that she wants to ask you. The national championship is being played. It's a tie game. There's a minute to go. She said, honey, I got something on my mind. And our response was, I say, what? Are you crazy? Not now. Can't you see? No, you just pick the remote up and say, "You pause." Yes, dear, what is it? See, I may overplay that a little bit, but you get the point. So we have to work on being considerate. The Bible speaks of that in the love chapter. In 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4, love is kind. In verse 5, love is not rude. The J.B. Phillips translation
which is not a word for word,
says love has good manners. That's being considerate. That's being thoughtful. That's saying please and thank you. I'm going to write a post on this week, if I can get it out. Two little words that would change your life. My wife gave me this article out of Good Housekeeping. And I have to admit, I typically don't read Good Housekeeping magazine. But she had a copy of it and was reading it. Two little words that will change your life. And the two little words were thank you. Thank you. And the whole article was about being grateful, being considerate, and just remembering to thank people. Work at being considerate. We're going to talk a little bit more about this verse in another lesson. But 1 Peter 3:7 says, husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives. Just work on that, and your marriage will get better quick. Number four, compromise during conflict. Now, it may be shocking to some of you young people that are in love and you're dating and you're anticipating. I talked to one young lady already that is looking forward to getting married. I said to her, all young ladies want to get married. Right? Admit it, you do, of course. And this may be shocking to you young ladies that want to get married, but after you get married, there's going to be conflict. Hard to believe, I know. Hard to believe. But that's a part of life. That's a part of relationships. All marriages have conflict. And guess what? If we're going to have a Christ-centered marriage and follow biblical principles, we must learn to compromise sometimes in the conflict. 1 Corinthians 13:5, love doesn't demand its own way. And no matter how much you love your spouse, there are going to be some things with which you disagree. There are going to be some things you have to compromise on. I think it's Gary Smalley that tells this story about a young couple getting married. And how that a lot of times when you're dating, you don't always talk about these kinds of things. But they were so in love and they got married and they went away and they had a great honeymoon. And they get back to their little apartment on the first night after their honeymoon. And he wakes up the next morning thinking how great it's going to be for her to get up and fix a big breakfast for him. You laugh. She wakes up thinking how great it's going to be for him to fix a great breakfast, because in her family, her dad always fixed breakfast. In his family, his mom always fixed breakfast. And so they wake up that very first morning back home with different set of expectations. Going to have to be a little compromise there on who fixes breakfast. Someone's got to carry out the trash. Someone's got to walk the dog. Someone's got to pay the bills. And there's all these kind of things that happen. Vacations. You got to think about, where are we going on vacation? What are we going to do? How much are we going to spend? Visiting relatives. And sometimes you get married, and you got relatives maybe in one state and another set of relatives in another state. Even if in the same town, you get this conflict on who are we going to have Christmas with? Who are we going to have Thanksgiving with? And how are we going to... And these don't sound like big issues sometimes in a building like this when we're all happy and we're all young and in love and we think we'd never have any conflict. But I'm going to tell you what, they can be the source of some bitter battles of deciding some of those kind of things. How are you going to spend money? You know, sometimes you enter into a relationship and... not always, but sometimes it's the female that has grown up a home where money wasn't much of an issue. And she just kind of spent whatever she wanted. Now she's not living with mom and dad anymore. They're starting out on a smaller budget. Money becomes an issue. You can't just spend unlimited amounts of money, usually, for most of us getting started. How are we going to spend our leisure time, our recreation? How are you going to raise children? I don't think Norma Jean and I ever one time in the year and a half we dated before we got married talked about raising children. We weren't thinking about that. But you know what? One day, little Kenny came along, and then these things come up. And sometimes you find out when the children come along, you have two totally different philosophies about raising children. A lot of it's going to go back to how you were raised. A lot of times. And if you're very happy with the environment of your parents, you think, well, that's the way to raise children. And maybe your spouse was raised a different way, and they think that's the way to raise children. Or maybe your parents raised you in such a way that you didn't like it. And so you're going to be just the total opposite of the way they raised you. And so you both enter into marriage without it. So there's all of these things that we've got to work on and compromise during conflict. But I will tell you, if we don't learn to compromise during marital conflicts, you're going to have a big problem. And pretty soon you're not going to be together. All right. Number five is courtship after marriage. Gary Smalley, in one of his videos, talks about this. He said, men are hunters. They're achievement-oriented. They're goal-directed. Men woo a woman in romance, and sometimes a man thinks it's time for me to get married. Now, one sage said, no man ever decides to get married. It's decided for him. I don't know about that. But at any rate, a man thinks he decides to get married. And he sets that as his goal to do that. But subconsciously, once you're married, a man thinks mission accomplished. And so a man begins to think subconsciously, how am I going to support this woman? And he becomes then absorbed in his career and being successful in his profession of making a living now for this family. It's amazing sometimes to talk to younger couples. And they are upset because there's no romance. And I'm blown away with this. I had a young fellow come to me before we moved from Tampa. And he and his wife hadn't been married a year. And I couldn't believe the marital problems and the lack of romance in their marriage in less than a year. But it can become a problem sooner or later if we're not careful. And so we need to work at that. And of course, the other thing is we see each other differently, usually, after we're married, than we see each other before. Maybe unkempt and unshaven and in the morning at the worst times possibly, the way we look, emotionally drained, tired, run down, all of those kind of things. So we have to work at courtship after marriage. The wise man said in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, to live joyfully with your wife whom you love all the days of your life. And then the wise man in Proverbs said, rejoice with the wife of your youth and always be enraptured with her love. He's talking about romance and even goes on to talk about the sexual relationship in marriage. And there's a good day to be able to read about in the Bible about that. Hey, have you ever read the Song of Solomon? I mean, that's not G-rated stuff in the Song of Solomon. I mean, that's serious marriage manual kind of material for couples that want to have a strong relationship in their marriage. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, 1 through 5, that Paul even addresses the conjugal rights and relationship that you have in marriage and the importance of that. And so the Bible is not silent on this topic whatsoever. And so we need to work at that courtship after. How do you do that? Well, just in a practical way, let me suggest some things to you that Norma Jean and I have tried, and I know that other couples have. Have a date night. Norma Jean and I still have a date night. Now, we try to do it once a week on a Friday night. Now, it doesn't always work out. Maybe we get invited to go somewhere, and, you know, I say, well, that's our date night. She said, that's okay. We'll make that our date night. Norma Jean was gracious enough a few weeks ago that we had our date night watching one of our young men at Hickman play basketball. And so that was good. That was a good date night for me. I don't know about her, but it was a good date night, okay? All right, to go out and eat and go watch a basketball game. But don't try that every Friday night, guys. That's not going to fly every Friday night, okay? But maybe that's too much. Maybe once a month. It depends on what your schedule and budget and all those kind of things will allow you. But you need to have a date night. And then another thing you need to do, you need to get away from the kids And I'm going to put an arbitrary number on this, but I'm going to say at least once a month to go out by yourselves. If you've got young children, then you're busy. You're busy. And there's a lot going on in your home. And you need to get a babysitter, and at least once a month, the two of you go out. Now, I don't know how I learned this at such a young age, but when our son came along, somehow we knew that and decided that we weren't going to be one of these couples that we took our kids everywhere. That they would be okay once in a while with someone else. And that we needed time to ourselves to go out and to be together. And I just recommend that to you. Because if your whole life is wrapped up in your children, and everything revolves around the children, one day those kids are going to leave home. And then it's just going to be the two of you. And you know, that's one of the reasons why there's so many divorces today with people in their 40s and 50s. They wake up one day and look at each other and they have nothing in common. It's all been wrapped around the kids and now they're gone. Now what are we going to do? And so spend some time with each other. And then another thing I recommend is get away for a weekend. Now, again, that's going to depend on your situation and your time and your budget and all those kind of things. But, you know, if you could do it, you know, once every 3 or 4 months, that'd be good. At least a couple times a year that you get away, just the two of you someplace. Even if it's just an overnight trip somewhere. You know, Houston, we're close to Galveston. Is that right? I've never been down to Galveston. I hear it's pretty nice down there. There's places you can go down there and stay for a night or two and enjoy yourself. Is that right? You might want to do that. You might want to get someone to watch the kids for the weekend and go down there for a night or two. And just relax and enjoy being with each other. Those are a few things that I think will help you. Oh, certainly. Guys, don't forget the special days. Don't forget her birthday and your anniversary and Valentine's Day. You don't want to forget that. You don't want to be in a doghouse, do you? Okay, don't forget those days. Those are the kind of things that add romance to your marriage. All right, number six is Christ is the center of your relationship. You see, in reality, Christ gives you power for everything else. Communication and consideration and compromise and courtship and commitment and all of those kinds of things. He gives you the staying power. Because when human love wears out, then divine love conquers all. And you need Christ. The greatest thing you can do for your marriage is to put Jesus in the center of that relationship. This is the third time now we've mentioned this verse already in this series in Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. Christ is our role model when it comes to agape love. You know, the interesting thing about the word love there, here I'll go into the Greek again. Uh-oh. You know, in the Greek language, there's four words for love. You've heard this, haven't you? You know, there is the word eros, which is sexual love. That word's never found in the Bible. And then there's the word storge, which is family love. That's found a couple times in the Bible. Then there's phileo, which is tender affection or feeling, a friendship kind of love. That's found quite a few times in the Bible. And then there is agape. And agape is a love of the will, a benevolent love. It's a decision that you make. Now, unfortunately, I've already tipped you off that husbands love your wives is not eros. Now, we would like for it to be, wouldn't we, guys? Christ commanded that, eros. That's not the word. It's not storge, it's not phileo, it's agape. It's agape love. A love of the will. A decision that we make. And you know, Christ loved us when we were unlovable and unlovely. And when we didn't love him and didn't reciprocate his kindness and consideration and even rebelled, that Christ loved us. Maybe there's an example there for us that not all the time will everything go like it should in our relationships. But if we have agape love, we have an unconquerable goodwill a benevolence that will continue regardless of what the other person does in the relationship. That's agape love. And then to the females, Paul wrote to Titus, he said, admonish the young women to love their husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. Now, if you're a young lady in love and fixing to get married or just married, you might think, how would you need to be commanded to love your husband? And if you wonder how that can be, you haven't been married long enough. Because sooner or later, he's going to do things that are unlovable. And it's going to call upon you to love him. And Paul says, have the older women teach the young women to love their husbands. Again, that's the word agape. When you don't love your husband, you know what you're doing? Listen to me. You're blaspheming the word of God. That's what he says, isn't it? That the word of God be not blasphemed. You know, through the years, I've been privy, of course, to a lot of conversations. Some intentional, where people come to me. And other times unintentional, where I've been in my office and the ladies are doing a little work in a workroom or the teacher resource room or folding bulletins or whatever. And I was in a place one time where the ladies always came over. That's back in the day where everybody sent out bulletins. And we had hundreds and thousands of bulletins. And they'd come over to fold and address the bulletins. And I tell you what, that's back when I had curly hair, because some of the stuff they said curled my hair. I want to tell you what, and these were wives of elders and deacons and Bible class teachers, of core members. I was a young preacher, I couldn't hardly believe the way these ladies would talk about their husbands. To one another, let alone with me being an earshot when they knew that I could hear them. I guess they knew that. Be careful what you say about your husband. Be careful your attitude, ladies. Yeah, he's going to do some things that are not lovable. And that's when you're called to a higher standard, to love him when he's not so lovable, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Put Christ at the center of your relationship. And I might just ask all of you tonight, husbands and wives and parents and children, is Christ at the center of your relationship? Now, that brings us down to number 7, Mark, and I've run out of time. So guess what we're going to do? Because of the nature of this series, see, sometimes I do this series in 5 lessons, and sometimes in 6, and sometimes 7, and sometimes 8. And so these secrets kind of vary a little bit. And so I've got time, because we're going through Thursday night. Secret number 7 is going to be tomorrow night's lesson. The whole lesson on it. And we're going to deal with the issue of compatibility tomorrow night. Have you ever heard someone say, well, preacher, I know what you're saying, but we're just not compatible. Is that right? Well, come back tomorrow night, and we're going to discuss this whole issue of compatibility and learn how we can overcome incompatibility if you don't think you're so compatible. Well, I'm glad you're here tonight. I hope this lesson has been helpful and practical and something, you know, there's something you can use tonight. Oh, and I forgot one of the points. I put on the notes there, and you can just read about this. I have a blog called The Preacher's Word. Okay? So I'm going to give you a little assignment. How many of you have this thing that Al Gore invented called the internet? Just a few of you. I'm surprised that more of you don't have it. Okay. Well, the few of you that raise your hands that have the internet, go to my blog, The Preacher's Word, and type in the search engine the word kiss. Now, I have an article entitled, When a Kiss is More Than Just a Kiss. Young people, don't read that, okay? Oh, they're already on, I see. Okay. By the way, you know when our young people have their cell phones out, they're not texting, they have their Bible on their cell phones. In fact, someone showed me they were taking notes on it. I learned that back in Tampa from the college students. So I never get excited about that. I trust them. I know they wouldn't dare to. In fact, I always told the students down in Florida, if you're doing any texting at all, it better be to me and it better be saying amen. The morning I said that, I picked up my phone in my office and I had 9 amens on my phone. So if you're tempted to text, come and see me afterwards. I'll give you my cell phone number and you can text me amen. All right? How's that? Well, I want you to read that article, When a Kiss is More Than Just a Kiss, because that'll bless you. And if you'll read it tonight and follow what it says, it'll bless you before you leave work in the morning. Married couples, I promise you. Thanks for coming tonight. Thanks for listening so well. I hope the lesson's blessed us. As we close tonight, we sing the song that's been selected, a song of invitation and encouragement. If you owe a duty to God, in some way we can help you, that we can minister to you. Maybe there's something in your life that you need to make right with God. Maybe you're not a Christian. And tonight, through faith, repentance, and baptism, you have become a child of God. We'd sure like to help you. But you know what? It might just be that the greatest response to our lesson tonight, your answer to the invitation, is not going to be coming down the aisle or a public one. It may well be a private one, where when we stand and sing, you just kind of say a little prayer, say, Lord, I haven't been a very good husband, forgive me. Or I haven't been a very good wife, forgive me. And it may well be that you want to go home tonight and take a few minutes and sit around your kitchen table and just talk to each other a little bit and ask for each other's help and pledge to each other that you're going to do better and work at this thing that we call the family and that we call marriage. If you could respond in that way, wouldn't that be wonderful? And to strengthen your home and thereby strengthen his church family. But if we can help you in a public way, would you come now as we stand and sing?